Here's a quick quiz. Who is the architect of the New Deal? Easy, right? Well, you'd think so. However,
18% of Americans said AOC as opposed to Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, a new survey says we need better civics education. We'll also talk about the 100th anniversary of a major medical breakthrough and spend an academic minute building a tavern. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. So where are we with civics education these days? According to a recent survey from the American Council of Trustees and Alumni, not so good. The poll found, among other surprising results, that a good amount of people thought that Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was the author of the New Deal. Here to talk about this new poll and the organization that conducted it is Jonathan DeLuzny, the Director of Academic Affairs at the American Council of Trustees and Alumni.
Well, it was a survey that we conducted in August through NORC, the gold standard when it comes to public opinion research out of the University of Chicago. And it was a survey of 1,002 American adults from across the country. And we wanted to get a sense of where things stand in terms of civic literacy. You know, I think we all have some sense that probably Americans don't know as much as they should about the country, its history, constitutional principles. But we wanted a few specifics, and I think part of the reason for that is that we want to be able to shine a light on this problem to a particular audience, and that would be university boards of trustees and regents, administrations, university faculties, such that we can generate some enthusiasm to maybe start fixing the problem.
What do you see as the fix?
Well, I think the fix would be more attention to civics education on public, but also private university and college campuses. And that's not just political science necessarily. We are big proponents of broad chronological history courses, as well as classes that focus on American founding principles or public policy over time. So the history of public policy class, that's the kind of class that we would like to see more of and we think would pay real dividends when it comes to good governance.
Well, let's get into the survey just a little bit. What were some of the answers, the results that made you kind of scratch your head saying, we need a little help?
Great. Well, we asked 15 questions. There were a couple that went very well. The one that probably has received the most attention so far is a question about the architect of the New Deal, just asking, who was it? And about 18% of Americans said AOC as opposed to Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Some people might call it a bit of a tricky question, right, given the Green New Deal. And I think our position there would be that Americans have to have a kind of nuanced understanding. You can't really think about the Green New Deal if you don't know something about the New Deal. So that's one that's received the most attention. But I actually think that there are some that are even a bit more alarming. So, for example, we asked about who has the power to declare war. 41% of Americans said the executive, 14% said the Pentagon, right? And so together, that's 55% of Americans who think that the power to declare war resides within the executive branch. The correct answer, of course, is the legislative branch, and about one-third of Americans, or 36% of Americans, got that one right. So that's one of the ones that, you know, really sort of gave us pause. We asked about the father of the Constitution, and 15% of Americans said James Madison. Of course, many people say either George Washington or Thomas Jefferson, so it's close, but the Constitutional Convention was really led by James Madison. And this is one where those with a college education didn't do much better. We only saw 17% get of that subpopulation get that question right.
I'm feeling much, much better about myself because I got them all right. And it seems that a lot of these answers are based on current news events because according to 26%, Brett Kavanaugh is the Chief Justice.
Yeah, so we did ask a couple that would allow for a kind of confusion, that might make people take notice, right? And that's a great example of one that didn't go so well. And, it's kind of alarming given how long the country spent talking about the Kavanaugh confirmation, that out of all of that conversation, there wasn't a really good understanding of what job he had been nominated for. That same question, we had 14% of Americans say Antonin Scalia, right? Who, of course, the late Antonin Scalia. I mean, he died in 2016. That's a question that college-educated Americans didn't do much better on. In fact, 16% of college-educated Americans answered Scalia instead of Roberts.
I think the one that really stood out to me, and it's just, how could they not know that, was 63% didn't know the term lengths of senators and representatives.
Yeah, I think we collectively gasped at that one. There, though, 49% got it right among those who had a college degree, so almost to half.
Okay. And questions, of course, about Harriet Tubman, which I didn't see the results on that. How did people do on that?
So that actually was the single best question. And so here we gave four different civil rights legacy when we asked what Harriet Tubman is best known for. We had 78% get that question right, where the right answer is, what was she known for, guiding slaves through the Underground Railroad. So that one was somewhat heartening. And I think it shows that the emphasis on sort of multiculturalism in K-12 is paying dividends, right, and that we are seeing people retain that. Could also be the discussion about the $20 bill we speculate that raised public awareness.
Yeah, I'm wondering if there wasn't that speculation about the $20 bill, whether half the people would have known that name.
Yeah. And so we were happy, right, to see that, when you get these ideas out there, they do seem to stick.
And the other one was what freed the slaves. And you know what? I kind of looked at that and said, wait a minute. But no, I did get it right at the end.
We designed this one to test for nuance, right? And so we asked, what government action freed all the slaves in the United States? And we gave both the Emancipation Proclamation and the 13th Amendment as answers. And so you have to know have a little bit of depth, I think, to answer this one correctly. And here we only got 12% respond correctly, 19% among college-educated Americans. And, of course, the Emancipation Proclamation was wrong, right? I mean, it's an understandable mistake, but that's by far what most Americans answered.
Well, let's talk about your organization. I mean, first of all, you have to have a big interest in this to actually do this survey.
Yeah, so ACTA is an organization that's going into its 25th year, and we have three main priorities, right? So we advocate for academic excellence, especially in the liberal arts on college and university campuses. We advocate for accountability, so good governance and fiscal responsibility, especially. We're very alarmed by the rising cost of college. And we also advocate for intellectual diversity on campus. We believe that campuses should be marketplaces of ideas where there's academic freedom for faculty, but also for students. And we make these arguments with a particular audience in mind. We speak most often to governing boards and to policymakers at the state level. Now, as to the interest in civics education, I think our position here is a driving purpose of public post-secondary education was to increase civic understanding, both among the citizenry generally, to make possible deliberation about the policy issues that we face together. But we also think that post-secondary education should help to cultivate a cadre of civic leaders who have a real depth of understanding, right, that who understand the country's principles, its priorities, who understand the struggles that we've faced in order to realize some of those principles and priorities, and that understanding does give important context for the discussion of contemporary policy issues.
ACTA is releasing their 2019-2020 What Will They Learn report. What is this a report on, and what's it say?
So What Will They Learn is now in its 11th year, and it's probably our flagship publication. Every summer, we study 1,123 general education programs at four-year colleges and universities across the country, and we evaluate those core curricula, asking whether they require courses in seven priority subject areas that our Council of Scholars has identified as critically important for 21st century college education. So those are classes like American history or government, college level math, we want a class in the natural science, preferably one that includes a lab component, communications course, economics. And so we ask, you know, how many of those core courses does a particular campus require all students to take? And then we grade colleges and universities based on that outcome. So we have about 22, not about, we have precisely 22 A schools this year and 167 Fs, right? So, so the results are a little bit dispiriting, but over time we've seen some improvement.
Oh, I was going to say, how are you hopeful for the future? Are these things going to be improving?
Well, so we do see movement, and sometimes it's in the right direction. So, for example, Florida now requires all public institutions to teach American government or American history. And so one of the biggest moves we saw this year was schools in Florida getting credit for that civics component. Every year we see a couple of schools join the A rank. Sometimes they're universities that worked with us because they were interested in strengthening their core curriculum. And every year we probably see two or three dozen universities lose credit for a particular course. This year the single biggest change was actually with our literature requirement or our literature recommendation. 20 universities from this pool of, you know, 1,100, so about 2%, removed their literature requirements and no longer require all students to take a literature course, broadly conceived.
You're talking about higher education. Should these students have a better base in K through 12?
Yeah, absolutely, right. And we are big proponents of civic education in K through 12. But the issues are linked because high school teachers, middle school teachers, they all get their education at the universities, and typically public universities if we're talking about colleges of education. And so I think strengthening civic education in post-secondary will have the effect of helping to prepare and empower K to 12 teachers to do a better job teaching civics. I think the thing that I'd want to emphasize is that, you know, in our time of deteriorating public discourse, one of the things that can, I think, really help us there is a better sense of common purpose. And this is one of the things general education, and in particular, study of the American democracy or American history, was supposed to help cultivate. If you look back to 1945, there was a landmark Harvard report called General Education and Free Society. And that's the point that it was making, right? That every student who goes through that university's core curriculum should learn something about the American democracy, and not such that they're uncritical, right? But such that there's a sufficient understanding of the world we live in together that we can have policy discussions from a place where we acknowledge the same facts as a point of departure. Civility can be helped by trying to restore civic education. I think that's the thing I'd want to end on.
Jonathan DeLuzny is the Director of Academic Affairs at the American Council of Trustees and Alumni. You can read more and take the survey yourself at goacta.org. Still to come, the road to one of the greatest scientific breakthroughs of the 20th century began 100 years ago. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Well, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. 100 years ago, a young woman named Elizabeth Hughes was diagnosed with diabetes. In 1919, that was a death sentence. But not for Miss Hughes. Early in the 20th century, the medical world was on the brink of a breakthrough. Diabetics were being kept alive at the time by starvation, while researchers were working around the world to isolate the secret of insulin. The story of this exciting time in the history of medicine is the subject of the book Breakthrough, Elizabeth Hughes, The Discovery of Insulin and the Making of a Medical Miracle by Thea Cooper and Arthur Ainsberg. I spoke with Arthur Ainsberg when the book was first released and pointed out that what was so interesting and fun about this book is that they took a search that had been going on for centuries and turned it into a race against time.
You know, science builds slowly, little building blocks. And clearly, by the early 20th century, a lot was known about insulin. They knew about the pancreas. And the fact of the matter is, it really did become a race against time starting in the early 20th century. Because once they had identified the pancreas as the source, then the hope was, and several people had tried to isolate the secretion called insulin.
Now, your book focuses on four main characters, and they're really larger-than-life characters, even though they are, you know, real people. You had three doctors and one young woman who was an amazing patient. Tell us about Elizabeth Hughes.
Elizabeth Hughes was extraordinary. This was a little girl who, at the age of 11, was diagnosed with diabetes and at the year 1919. And in that, if you were diagnosed in 1919 before the discovery of insulin as a type 1 diabetic, which means that you're totally insulin dependent, your lifespan is from the moment of diagnosis to the moment of death, 11 months. And the only way the children lived longer is for those children who followed and were prescribed a diet called the Allen diet, which in effect was a starvation diet. And Elizabeth Hughes was on this diet for 39 months. She outlived what anyone had thought at the time of the diagnosis. She lived on as little as 400 calories a day. She kept to her diet in a fastidious manner throughout that time. When she was close to death, 39 months into the starvation diet, weighing 46 pounds and being 15 years old, Elizabeth Hughes became one of the early recipients of insulin. And she received her insulin from the discoverer of insulin, Dr. Frederick Banting. And the reason she was able to be one of those early patients and his most famous patient was Elizabeth Hughes was the youngest daughter of Charles Evans Hughes, the only American ever to be a governor, secretary of state, associate justice, and then later chief justice of the United States.
And her illness changed American history because her father would have run for president in 1920 and would have won.
Her father would have won for president in 1920. There is no question about it. In 1916, he ran against Woodrow Wilson. He went to sleep in the Waldorf Astoria. He thought he was going to wake up as president, and he had lost California and lost the election. 1920 was really a year for the Republicans. Charles Evans Hughes was the nation's most famous politician in 1920. And what happened was is that Elizabeth's sister, Helen, was diagnosed early 1918 with tuberculosis. She died in April of 1920, and at the same time that his eldest daughter had died, his youngest daughter, Elizabeth Hughes, was diagnosed with this incurable disease. And it was just emotionally overwhelming for Charles Evans Hughes, and he decided and he chose not to run.
Now, you said, too, that Elizabeth was on a starvation diet called the Allen diet. That is after Dr. Frederick Allen, who was another one of the major characters in this book.
Frederick Allen was a doctor. He was a brilliant clinician, a brilliant researcher. He was given $5,000 by his father, which represented 25% of his father's entire estate, in order to publish his findings on diabetes. And it was Allen's 1,300-page book on diabetes that really made him Dr. Diabetes during that era. And it was his book and his research which really determined that if an individual restricts his diet and reduces his proteins, his fats, his carbohydrates, and really becomes almost like a living skeleton, he will live longer, whether he be a type 1 or a type 2 diabetic. And people used to walk around in 1915, 1918, he used to walk around with a little red book, and this little red book was the Allen diet, and in parentheses it said starvation diet. That was the manual that if you were a diabetic, that you carried around with you.
And you said Elizabeth was living on as little as 400 calories a day. This is, and when you say starvation, you absolutely mean it. These were walking skeletons, these people, but it was the only way at that time they could stay alive.
Many of his patients died of starvation. They did not die of diabetes. They literally starved themselves to death. And one of the most interesting parts of the book was the decision that parents had to make at that point in time. Do I let my child, who was just diagnosed with an incurable disease, live out his or her life and just eat regularly, knowing that the child will be dead in a short amount of time? Or do I go put the child on the Allen diet and hope that a miracle happens? And Elizabeth's parents made that decision, as did many other parents.
Now, the miracle was happening little by little in Toronto, and that's where Dr. Frederick Banting and his team comes in. He had an out-of-the-box idea, had really tough time getting funding for it, but the University of Toronto finally gave him a little space anyway to start his work, and that's where the miracle started.
It started with Frederick Banting writing down on October 31st of 1920, 25 words, and that really began the discovery of insulin. He went to the University of Toronto. He approached a very famous doctor there, J.J.R. McLeod. McLeod ran the department. McLeod gave Banting a research assistant named Charles Best, and at the same time, he gave him a laboratory and about 10 dogs to do their research with, and that was the beginning. Insulin cost $1,400 to discover. And then after it was discovered by Banting and Best and McLeod and a fourth person named Bertram Collop, after they discovered it and they were getting small quantities, but the small quantities weren't always potent, and unfortunately some of them were in effect toxic and there were abscesses and other situations, they turned to a small little drug company in Indianapolis, Indiana, to help them mass produce insulin.
And it's not such a small drug company right now, is it?
No. It is not. But in 1921, 22, at the time that they were doing their work on figuring out a way to mass produce insulin, Eli Lilly Company was a company that had been in business almost 50 years. The Eli Lilly Company was a change company after they figured out how to mass produce insulin.
And the fourth of your major characters was one of the men who worked for Eli Lilly, and that was Alec Clues.
That's correct. Alec Clues was an Englishman who had come to America in 1903, had spent 16 years living in New York State, in fact, working in Buffalo at what is now known as the Roswell Institute. And he was recruited by Eli Lilly himself, the grandson of the founder, Colonel Eli Lilly. And he was a research scientist. And he is the one who reached out to McLeod after he had heard what had happened, went to a conference, met Banting. And the one theme among all of the people in this book, who are all forgotten figures in American history, the one thing that is so fascinating is that they all had enormous perseverance. And Clues had originally been turned down by the researchers. They wanted to try to do it themselves. And finally, after 4 or 5 months of total despair and disappointment, they gave Eli Lilly Company a one-year license to try to mass produce insulin.
Well, in that time, partnering with a pharmaceutical company was seen as just not a thing. It's not something an academic would do.
That is correct. The relationship and the association between Eli Lilly Company and the University of Toronto was the first collaboration between a university and a corporation. After that, there have been many, many others, but this was the first.
So much changed when that happened, because at that point, the care of diabetics meant it was just a death watch and just writing down, observations. Frederick Allen started it with the starvation diet and his physiatric institute that he opened for diabetics. Basically, the discovery of insulin put him out of business.
It put him out of business. And not only that, he went bankrupt. He really never recuperated from his bankruptcy financially. He's buried with a stone in a very small plot in a cemetery in Long Island. And it says one word on that stone. It gives the year of his birth, the year of his death, and it says doctor. This was a man who should have had a mausoleum in the middle of Central Park. Because if you think about all the men and women who are alive today because of Frederick Allen's starvation diet and keeping the children and the adults living until insulin was discovered, it would number many more than thousands of people.
There are so many heroes in this story, and there are some very, very famous names in the book. Some presidents are in this book. I take a look at one guy, and I feel sorry for this. The guy is Austin Brown, purchasing agent for Eli Lilly, who got called into a meeting with the president of the company and said, we need 2,000 pounds of pancreas a week. Can you do that for us?
Exactly right. The way insulin was made for many, many years, literally until in America, till 1996, it was made by using animal pancreases, which was a waste product of stockyards. And literally, because of the discovery of insulin, Eli Lilly Company reached out to every stockyard in America, and the message was very clear. Send us your pancreases, ship them here by refrigerated train cars. We will take them all. And because of that, insulin was available around the world 2 years after its discovery. And just think about today, where it takes 10 to 15 years to get a drug to market and costs literally over $1 billion a year. How many thousands and millions of people are alive today because of that two-year window?
Again, the name of Arthur Ainsberg and Thea Cooper's book is Breakthrough: Elizabeth Hughes, The Discovery of Insulin and the Making of a Medical Miracle. If you want to know what was important to early British settlers, you have to study taverns. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
The tavern was a special place in colonial America. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Vaughn Scribner, assistant professor of history at the University of Central Arkansas, explores the history of these pub, lick places.
In 1710, a British captain exclaimed, "Upon all the new settlements the Spaniards make, the first thing they do is build a church. The first thing the Dutch do upon a new colony is to build them a fort. But the first thing the English do, be it in the most remote part of the world, is to set up a tavern." He was right. 18th century Britons loved the tavern. And since British American colonists believed they were creating a new world in North America, they also believed they needed their beloved taverns as central building blocks of a colonial American civil society. From exclusive city taverns to seedy, disorderly houses, urban taverns were wholly ingrained in the diverse web of colonial American life. By the mid-18th century, urban taverns emerged as the most popular, numerous, and accessible public spaces in British America. These shared spaces, which hosted individuals from a broad swath of socioeconomic backgrounds, eliminated the notion of civilized versus uncivilized individuals and dismayed the elite colonists who hoped to impose a British-style social order upon their local community. More importantly, urban taverns served as critical arenas through which diverse colonists engaged in an ongoing act of societal negotiation. My research demonstrates how colonists' struggles to emulate their British homeland ultimately impelled the creation of an American republic. This insight reveals the messy, often contradictory nature of British American society building. In striving to create a monarchical society based upon tenets of civility, order, and liberty, colonists inadvertently created a political society that the founders relied upon for their visions of a republican America. This is not to argue that independence was inevitable. Rather, a fuller understanding of America's unexpected independence demands a deep analysis of mid-century colonists' societal dreams and, perhaps more importantly, anxieties. Everything and nothing has changed.
That was Vaughn Scribner of the University of Central Arkansas. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org, and you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.